You can now take KRBN Internet News Talk Radio with you on your mobile phone, as we are making it easier to listen to the great hosts here on KRBN, including our very own West Lane County Commissioner, Jay Bozovich. It's free and available on Google Play. Just look for player.fm. That's player.fm and search for KRBN.
Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Boz Knows Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bozovich. And now, here's Jay.
And good afternoon. And it's another beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest, and I want to welcome you to the Boz Knows Show, and I'm your host, Jay Bozovich, West Lane County Commissioner, and we're live today from beautiful downtown Elmira, Oregon, and it's a little bit grayish out there. We're starting to get an AQI up in the 80s sort of range, a little bit of smoke blowing in from some of the fires here, but not as bad as it has been. It's actually been pretty nice first smoke intrusion we've had in probably about a week here in the Willamette Valley, but around the Eugene Springfield area. But overall, you know, it's our typical drop dead northwest gorgeous summer here, about 83 degrees outside. I think the relative humidity is about 30%. Of course, that kind of makes good conditions for fire though, which is why we get a little bit of smoke. And you know, we talked a lot about smoke last week on the Boz Knows Show. I will mention that there is a set of rules that they're considering on smoke management between the Oregon Department of Forestry and Department of Environmental Quality about doing controlled burns in our forest and how they manage the smoke on that. And just hope that the state doesn't make it harder to do that, because those controlled burns done at the right time of year are actually what reduces fuel loads in a very natural way, gets rid of that underbrush and those ladder fuels, and makes the forest a whole lot safer, so that they're not as conducive to catching on fire. And if they do catch on fire, it's easier to put them out and less smoke. So a lot of times they can do those controlled burns. They watch the weather so they get a good ventilation day. They do it when there's enough humidity and rainfall that it doesn't get out of control. And they can do some great management of our forest with controlled burning. So really hope that the new smoke management rules don't make it any harder to do that. In fact, they probably should make it a whole lot easier to do that, seeing we've been living with breathing that stuff in the wrong time of the year when it's not ventilating and causing all sorts of problems here in the state of Oregon and all over the Northwest, from British Columbia down to California, with wildfire this year. So just a little side note on smoke today on the Boz Knows Show, but we have all sorts of things to talk about, but I'll talk about what you want to talk about, because that's more interesting to me than anything else I want to talk about. 646-721-9887, and just press 1, and that lets Robin, my call screener and producer extraordinaire, know that you want to get in on the show and you're not just dialing in to listen, as we do have a couple people that use their phones to listen when they're on the road and can't get internet. So again, it's 646-721-9887, and just press 1 to get in the show and you can control the topic. If not, we're going to talk about what Jay wants to talk about. And I've got something on my mind, just, you know, with the news of the last couple of days, as the Senate confirmation hearings opened up on Brett Kavanaugh as the nominee for the Supreme Court of the United States, known as SCOTUS. They kind of got off to a pretty rocky start, you know, with the protest and the motions to adjourn immediately and all the delaying and everything else. And it continued on this morning somewhat. And it just reminded me, as I watched some of that news coverage, of some of the meetings that I've participated in as an elected official, and I've even had to chair as an elected official, where a group came in specifically to be disruptive, to be, you know, to try and sway us in a particular direction. But they did it in a way similar to what was going on in these Senate confirmation hearings, where they would interrupt the meeting, scream out from the audience, generally be rude. And you know, when we did get them to actually come up and give verbal testimony, quite often the testimony wasn't an argument, you know, a logical argument as to why we should decide in the direction they want to, or even an emotional argument as why we should decide in the direction they want to. It was mostly a personal attack against the commissioners that were going to be making a decision, and generally degrading us because they felt like we weren't going to rule in their favor. And I kind of just, it boggles my mind that anyone could think that those sort of tactics actually convince a deliberative legislative body, or, you know, whatever body is making decisions, like the Senate Judiciary Committee or the Lane County Board of Commissioners or your local city council or a planning commission, that somehow or another that's going to swing them to your side of the argument because you're shouting out, interrupting from the audience, you're personally insulting the members of the body, and not actually addressing the issue before the body in a way that will help inform a decision. And it just amazes me that people come in there thinking that we can somehow or another get to the point of agreeing with them by being so abusive and rude and disruptive. Just makes me really wonder, you know, what are they thinking? I mean, we have our show segment, What Were They Thinking? So I want to kind of throw this out there. This is kind of Jay's What Were They Thinking for today. You know, what were those protesters thinking, that somehow or another their protest and disruptions were going to convince the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee to vote no on Brett Kavanaugh, that somehow or another that behavior was going to be convince somebody to change their vote from a yes to a no? I mean, really? And has it ever been successful, that sort of protest and interruption? I haven't personally seen it be successful. In fact, you know, when it happens personally to me, that happens, it almost makes me, you know, swing further away from that side. Even though I try to be very objective and weigh the facts in a decision, that sort of behavior kind of makes you, you know, repulsed from that side's arguments in a lot of ways. You know, if it's laced with rude behavior and being impolite, personal attacks and insults, and it just, I don't understand why people think somehow or another that's helping their cause. So, if you disagree with me, or you have an example where that sort of disruptive rudeness and all that ever won the day for a cause, was ever successful in changing the minds of an elected body, I would love to hear about it, because I really don't think in the long run it changes people's minds, or even in the short run. You know, what's more likely to change my mind is somebody that comes up to give their testimony in a polite fashion and provides an argument that I haven't thought about before, and might actually go, you know what, I haven't considered that. Maybe I should think about that aspect of this decision and take that into consideration with my decision making. Certainly being chanted at, or, you know, having things interrupted or being accused of being bought, whatever it is that people do, does not help me decide in their favor. Somebody wants to make a calm, you know, cognizant argument, or even a, you know, an emotional plea to side with them, you know, that adds new information, addresses the criteria we're basing our decision on. That's the kind of thing that will actually swing a deliberative body towards your decision. I have yet to see a deliberative body Other than I've seen them have to stop, not taking action immediately on a particular day because a disruption actually shut a meeting down. But ultimately, they come back in and make the decision, usually against what the group that wanted to disrupt the meeting's, side of the cause, whatever that was. Ultimately, they bring the meeting back to order with security or whatever else, and rule and make a decision against the folks that stopped the meeting. So just as we watch, all the protest in the Senate confirmation hearings, think about, as an elected official, I'm kind of expressing my opinion. I'm sure other elected officials would confirm this. I don't get convinced by that sort of behavior. And it doesn't make me want to rule on your side. In fact, it has a tendency, which I have to guard against, to automatically want to rule against the side that exhibits that sort of behavior. So, it's to me, it's not useful. And I'd be curious if anyone else thinks it is useful. So give me a call here, 646-721-9887. Just press 1 and tell me about a time you thought being disruptive, protesting, and being rude in a public meeting actually won the day for the cause in the long run. I'd be curious about that. So just one of those things was on my mind. But a secondary thing that's on my mind about the Senate confirmation hearing, I've been on Capitol Hill. You do not get into a congressional hearing easily. I mean, it's a little bit easier maybe to get into the public gallery during a congressional session, but to actually get into a Senate hearing usually takes some Senate office getting you credentialed or ticketed to get into the gallery, because the galleries aren't very big for the hearings rooms. So my question is, what Senate office, staffer or senator, coordinated with the group that protested to interrupt the Senate proceedings and break Senate decorum that way? It seems to me there ought to be some kind of investigation to figure that out. The Senate should police itself and do that investigation and then possibly sanction the member that enabled and helped that protest occur. Because it seems to me that's just, they claim to be the world's greatest deliberative body, and they live by all these rules and procedures and stuff like that. Why one of the reasons it's so difficult to get everything through the Senate, you need 60 votes to close debate and this, that, and the other thing. And then some Senate office can figure out a way to get around security, get protesters, known protesters into a meeting, knowing they were going to do that. And there's no repercussions and no investigation into that. Seems to me they'd want to police themselves about that a little bit and kind of maybe avoid having that happen in the future. So I wonder what you guys think about that. We got a few other things we can talk about today. All sorts of things going on. Heard an interview this morning with Eugene City Councilor Mike Clark talking about City Hall. He has some interesting concepts. Of course, Mike's been a huge proponent of the City of Eugene buying the eWeb headquarters building and making that their City Hall. And that has some traction with some people. Couldn't quite get the majority of the City Council to vote to place it on the ballot. But it was interesting listening to Mike this morning lobby through the radio and his interview for that particular cause to use the eWeb headquarters building as a new City Hall and avoid the cost and save Eugene taxpayers some significant money and possibly create some efficiencies, because the eWeb headquarters building is a lot bigger than the proposed City Hall, and there'd be an ability to centrally locate a lot of city offices in that facility. So that is an interesting thing going on around town here. And of course, because it's Mike Clark involved, I didn't get a chance to hear if they actually said anything about this, but Uber and Lyft are finally coming to Eugene. And as much as I get along with Mike and he's a good friend, the one thing we disagreed on was his concerns over Uber and Lyft and some of the roadblocks he was putting in the way of them coming back to Eugene, Springfield area and Lane County. Ultimately, they loosened the rules enough that Uber and Lyft are willing to submit to some of the special conditions that Eugene's placing on them. And they are going to be back. In fact, Lyft started operations today, I believe, and Uber's starting tomorrow. And it's a great day for road safety in a lot of ways, because it has been shown that those services reduce drunk driving incidences in the cities that they operate in. I mean, there's, you know, nothing like being able to call an Uber or Lyft to head out for a night on the town and knowing that you can call them to get home safely without having to worry about, you know, did your designated driver have one beer or three beers, you know, or four beers? You know, was anybody keeping a close eye on the designated driver? All that stuff. So it's great to see Uber and Lyft coming into this area. And for another important couple important reasons, we have been struggling as we've been trying to become known as the Silicon Shire up here in the southern end of the Willamette Valley. And we have a significant tech sector here in Lane County. But as we're trying to promote that, promote growth, and folks come here from other areas like San Jose and Silicon Valley to the Silicon Shire, they can't believe as they get off the airplane that there was no Uber or Lyft service available. So here we are trying to promote ourselves as this high-tech place to come and you know, open companies, expand companies, move your company here. Yet we have, you know, we were not offering one of the most high-tech, innovative solutions to transportation that's, you know, developed over the last 50 years. I mean, really, you think about it, not much had changed in how you get around town before Uber, Lyft, and ride sharing, and that service through your phones. Yeah, there was a few, you know, vehicle sharing services and all that. They're kind of clunky through the internet and everything. But when those apps became popular on smartphones, that really changed a lot about transportation. You know, when was, you know, taxis have been around forever, you know, liveries, you know, for hire transportation. Mass transportation has been around forever. Trolleys, there were horse-drawn trolleys and horse-drawn carts in New York City long before, you know, that where you could get on in one area of New York and it would take you uptown with a whole bunch of other people, with people getting on and off on the way. That's been around forever. Yeah, now it might have evolved a little bit into bus rapid transit. Still not a big step away from that, you know, mass transit. And there's always been, you know, the single cars, you know, for people to get to and from and vehicle ownership. Uber and Lyft, though, kind of took and freed, you know, people up in a way where they could, you know, hail rides faster, quicker, easier. People could choose to drive for an hour at a time, for 2 hours at a time, you know, several days a week, you know, and you do it full time or just part time. And it really changed transportation quite a bit. And it's probably the biggest innovation in transportation we've seen in 50 years. Soon to be eclipsed, though, by the self-driving vehicles and autonomous vehicles. But that's not ready for prime time yet. Uber and Lyft have been around for a while, operating safely in multiple cities across the country with not a whole lot of incidences, you know, because we have, it's even been shown that even taxi services have problems. There's, you know, a couple of incidences recently in Eugene with DUII taxi drivers. So it's not like any system's perfect. Sure, there's probably going to be an incident sometime in the future with an Uber or a Lyft driver and the vehicle issue or something like that. But the chances are far lower than, you know, the general driving public in some ways, because they do have to go through a certain amount of background checks. Vehicles can't be over a certain age. You know, there's a lot that goes into that. Plus, you know, the Uber drivers, you know, want to get good ratings so people, you know, when they go to pick who they're getting picked up by, they can, you know, look at how many stars they have, and you know, you don't want to get picked up by somebody with a single star, you know. So there's a lot that, you know, the free market drives in that, in the way of safety and you know, responsiveness. But it was really cool to see Uber and Lyft coming back to the city. Interesting, you know, listening to Mike Clark talk about City Hall down at the UEB building today. So that kind of two things kind of tying together here in Lane County. But it's Uber and Lyft isn't just about Silicon Shire and being on the edge and drunk driving. It's also about our tourism economy. And we've been suffering because most people are used to now going wherever they go and being able to get a ride share to get from the airport to their hotel, from their hotel to whatever tourism destinations they want to get to a certain extent. And that's actually been hurting our tourism economy here in Lane County, not having the ride sharing services available. So I'm really looking forward to having those in Lane County. It'll be interesting to see if we do see a pickup in tourism. We're actually having a pretty good year so far. In the first month of our new fiscal year that's been logged in the books for Travel Lane County has already shown a significant increase in room sales and transient room tax revenues. So we're already doing better than the year before. So it's interesting to see if this Uber and Lyft will actually help pick that up and gain steam there. It'll be interesting to see, as I talk to our economic development professionals out there, whether we're seeing, you know, with Uber and Lyft being in the community, whether that's been more helpful in recruiting some of the firms that are coming here, and you know, if we see some, you know, job growth that results out of that. Not to mention, you know, it's going to be a real boon to a lot of U of O students that, you know, might want to have, you know, very strange schedules because class schedules change from quarter to quarter, and the ability to have something as flexible as driving for a ride share could be a real plus to those guys and their ability to earn extra money and maybe not have such large student loan debt when they graduate. So yay for Uber and Lyft and ride sharing in Lane County. And it's just great that we finally got the city of Eugene far enough along towards loosening up their rules that they agreed. Still think they didn't have to go. They still could have loosened them up even further and just matched Medford and some of the other cities, Ashland's rules for ride sharing. So throwing up a couple of things out there on the Bo's Nose Show, from City Hall to protesting and the Senate confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. You want to talk about those, or you want to talk about something else that's on your mind, it's 646-721-9887 here on the Bo's Nose Show. Just press 1 if you want to get in on the show. Again, that's 646-721-9887. Just press 1 to get into Bo's Nose Show. And there's other ways to get a hold of us here at the Bo's Nose Show. You can email us at talk@krbnradio.net. And again, that's talk@krbnradio.net. And you can also message us on Facebook. So we're broadcasting now on Facebook Live, the KRBN Internet News Talk Radio page. So KRBN Internet News Talk Radio on Facebook. And you can find us there and message us there. Of course, you can always get a hold of me about any issue through my Facebook page, which is Jay Bozovich, West Lane Commissioner, and I respond to messaging there. I also, you know, if you want to message my personal page, and there's a thousand other ways to get a hold of Jay Bozovich, you can also go to the lanecounty.org website and go under Board of Commissioners and find my page under the Board of Commissioners, and there's an email link there and my phone number to leave me a message. So all sorts of ways to get a hold of me. But if you want to get in on the show, you just have to dial 646-721-9887. Just press 1 and that lets Robin, my call screener and producer extraordinaire, know you want to get in on the conversation here. So, you know, we talked a little bit about City Hall. Last week we talked about ballot initiative measure 105 that's coming on the ballot and about supposedly the sanctuary laws here in Oregon. Also, September is Disaster Preparedness Month. So I just want to touch on that a bit because we're actually going to talk about our emergency preparedness department and where it sits in Lane County government at next week's board meeting on next Tuesday. And it's going to be an interesting conversation because And of all things, it's going to be on September 11th. We're going to talk about emergency preparedness. The current emergency, we only have really one person who's our emergency preparedness department in Lane County because we're a little bit resource limited. And she resides in the sheriff's office. And that's where it's located now. And it kind of makes it seem like it's a police function. And sort of limits people's thinking around that to it's about the police response to emergencies. It's really not. Our emergency preparedness goes well beyond that. And Linda Cook, who's our emergency program manager, goes well beyond the sheriff's office and touches everything from our public works, you know, who has to clear roads, you know, from all the branches in an ice storm to our folks over in public health that have to respond to an outbreak of meningitis at the University of Oregon. It's all branches of Lane County government that are involved in emergency management. And we're looking at moving that position and that function out of the sheriff's office and putting it in the county administrator's offices so it has a much higher profile and an umbrella over the entire organization of Lane County. So, you know, people aren't thinking sheriff's office, law enforcement response to emergencies. It's not just that. And that sort of response, it's about the entire organization's ability to respond and looking at, emergencies from contagious diseases all the way to natural disasters to man-made things like riot. We have to be prepared for it all. And September is Disaster Preparedness Month, and you have to be prepared too. And I was listening to another interview on radio this morning, and one of the things that they talked about was this idea that you know, you need 3 days worth of food that has been promoted for a long time. You should have 3 days worth of food, 3 days worth of food and water and all that stuff. And they're really starting to say you should have at least 2 weeks. Because particularly in this particular area of the Northwest, if we get some of the bigger storms and all that, it can be much more than 3 days before outside help's going to arrive. And most of the grocery stores in this area don't carry more than 3 days worth of food sales on their shelves. Without replenishment from the trucking industry and the railroad industry and the airline industry and all the various transportation. The transportation system's not working, say, like in an ice storm or widespread flooding. They run out of food in 3 days. So, you know, your personal store in 3 days, you get an event that lasts more than a week, and people are having trouble. You know, so really want to think about how you build up that 2 week supply. And it's not something you have to go out and try and buy 2 weeks worth of freeze dried food tomorrow. You know, that for a family of four. You know, that's just, you know, you don't have to go to that extreme. But you do need to start thinking about how to build that slowly, maybe, and work it into your budget over time. How to get some of the other things into your budget, like preparing a go bag, building up, ordering your prescriptions a little bit early every month so you eventually have an extra month's worth of pills so that, you know, the pharmacies close down and, you know, hell's broken loose. You've got enough of whatever prescription to last you for a couple of weeks so you can get outside help or be evacuated from the area. And that's pretty important when you think about some of the prescriptions folks are on nowadays, whether it's something as simple as some of these acid blockers that keep people from having acid reflux disease and the problems with that, that, you know, if you're not taking them once a day, you're right back to where you were in about 24 to 48 hours, to something as serious as medications that control arrhythmias of your heart, that control diabetes and all that, where it's actually life-threatening if you can't continue keeping your medications. So not just about food and water, it's about your medications, how you're going to keep warm, how you're going to keep dry. What if you have to evacuate your house after an earthquake because it's structurally unsound? Do you have a place to sleep? Like, you know, do you have a RV or do you have a tent? Those sort of things, kind of thinking all that through and slowly acquiring what you need to survive for 2 weeks on your own without government help. That's really what's going to make a resilient society here and make our emergency manager's job a whole lot easier. But we'll be talking about emergency management on September 11th at the Lane County Board of Commissioners meeting. So it should be an interesting conversation about trying to elevate that position, pull it up out of the sheriff's office and into county administration, where it will have countywide significance. So should be an interesting discussion next Tuesday. So, you know, there's some other ballot initiatives besides Measure 105 on the ballot. And if anyone wants to talk about those, we can. You know, one of the ones is about not taxing food, which I thought was kind of an interesting sort of ballot measure because it's a constitutional amendment about taxing food and includes a definition of groceries, has a few exemptions for alcohol and a few other things. But it's one of those things where I kind of, you know, it's currently not being taxed, and it's a preemptive constitutional amendment. And my concern is, you know, if what I consider the most fair form of taxation is a tax that's visible to the people that are paying it and is broadly distributed so it's the smallest percentage possible. And when you start saying I'm going to not tax food before we ever think about, you know, maybe switching to a sales tax, which is very visible to the people paying it, versus say a corporate income tax or a value added tax that is not visible to the folks that are paying it, or say a carbon tax, a cap and trade tax sort of thing. Those aren't visible taxes. I like taxes that people know they're paying. And really wish that when you got your receipt at the gas station, there was a how much it was for the gas and then how much it was for the gas, for the taxes on the gas, on the receipt every time you bought it. So you could see how much taxes you were paying every time you buy a tank of gas. So for me, preempting food before we ever think of that style of taxation will mean there's less we'll be able to tax in that way if we chose to go to a sales tax in the future, which means the tax will have to be higher on non-food items rather than lower on everything. And there's, you know, to me, you know, and there's ways to rebate or prebate to get people hold that, you know, when you start talking about taxing essentials and how that hurts the poor, there's ways to do that, to get around that without having to worry about that. So to me, this preemptive constitutional amendment to limit one particular category of products from taxation is a little heavy-handed. And I don't take lightly amending the Constitution of the state. I don't take lightly amending the Constitution of the United States. I don't take lightly amending our charter for our county. They are, you know, formative documents of our governments, and they really should be not amended for frivolous things, and preemptive is even worse in some ways. So I kind of measure 103, which is about not taxing food. It sounds great. Almost, I know it's going to pass. It's one of those things, kind of like the sanctuary thing. It's probably going to pass because people don't really understand some of the details behind the issue. But Measure 103, you know, is one of those ones where I'll probably be in the minority. I'm going to probably vote no on it. And I kind of wonder what other people think about that, because it just seems like, oh, well, you know, it's going to prevent one form of taxation. I hate taxes. I'm going to vote yes, you know. Without thinking about, ultimately, that's going to, we were to switch from an income tax in the state, which is a horrible way to tax people because it punishes what you want, which is you want people earning more money, versus, you know, and also punishes folks that save, whereas as a sales tax, actually, you know, consumer tax, you know, rewards people that are earning income and saving, and disincentivize people from just spending frivolously. You know, the way the system's set up in Oregon right now, people spend every dime in their paycheck because there's no consequence in doing so, and there is consequence on trying to save money because you'll get taxed on that interest of your savings, and you're paying into those savings with post-tax income. You know, so it's really, you know, a bizarre system. So ultimately, if it was to change over and we had already preempted food, we'd have to have a much larger sales tax on non-food items to switch over, which is going to make it even harder to switch in the future. So I just don't think Measure 103 is a great idea. Unfortunately, it's probably going to pass, you know, because there's such a dislike of sales taxes in the state of Oregon anyway, because it hasn't passed 9 times. And also the fact that everybody thinks that, you know, food shouldn't be taxed without really thinking carefully about that. If there are ways to rebate, you know, the subsistence level of taxation on food, you know, if you know that people in order to live have to buy at least, say, $400 worth of groceries a month or $600 worth of groceries a month, and the tax on that was going to be, $10 a month, you know, rebating those folks back that $10, you know, everybody back $10 a month, kind of levelizes that. So the folks that spend $1,200 a month on luxury groceries are paying tax on those groceries. So there's all sorts of ways to get around that. And there's a couple other measures on the ballot. There's a measure that I think is actually a pretty good measure, which is to better clarify something that passed a while back by a pretty overwhelming majority, which was to require a supermajority to raise taxes in the legislature. And the legislature has basically said, well, eliminating deductions so that your taxes go up isn't a tax increase. And calling something a fee is not a tax, so we don't need a supermajority on instituting this new fee. And that's the kind of thing that has been interesting to watch in the legislature, is the way they're trying to work around that constitutional requirement for a supermajority to raise tax rates. That one I do support. So there's one that you can put on your list that Jay's supporting right now, is that measure to better define what a revenue increase is and what requires a supermajority on the part of the legislature to increase or increase the revenues of the state. Throwing out a lot of stuff out there for you guys to talk about. Love to get somebody to call in. I know it's a 3-day week. Kids are starting school. Everybody's busy. Maybe they don't have time to call. But, you know, I want to hear from you. 646-721-9887. Just press 1, and that gets you into the show. Again, 646-721-9887, and just press 1. And speaking of raising revenue, Robin, my call screener and producer extraordinaire, had to register her vehicle or renew her registration for a vehicle recently, and got a little surprise there, didn't you, Robin?
Oh, my God. Yeah. For regular plates, nothing fancy, $112.
Yeah, which, having come from a state that actually taxed you based on the value of your vehicle when you registered, it's really not that much compared to some other states, but it's still, what was it before that, $72 or something like that?
Yeah, $73, I think it was.
Yeah, it was relatively cheap. Pretty significant jump there, and that was part of House Bill, I think it was 2017, was that it? Yeah, 2017, which was the transportation bill, which not only raised the vehicle registration fees, it also raised the gas tax that the state charges, and is going to keep raising it over the next several years at 2%, 2 cents of increase, for a total of, I think, 10 cents increase on the state gas tax. And also it raised some other revenues, like you now have to pay a tax when you purchase a car, and you also have to pay a tax when you purchase a bicycle over a certain dollar amount, which, you know, it was one of those bills that had something everybody didn't like.
And you're forgetting one other tax.
It also had the mass transit tax.
Yep.
And income tax.
Yep.
So, all sorts of new taxes. I can't remember. I think they did have a 3/5 majority for that one.
Theory about all this. We're all independently wealthy and they want our money.
Yeah. Well, there is a need to keep a transportation system up and running, but there are some things that they could also do to make it cheaper for us local governments and the state to do that. And one of those things is we could definitely, you know, look at some of the what I call the little Davis-Bacon laws here in the state around prevailing wage would help out. Some of the public contracting law makes it more expensive for public agencies to contract to have work done versus a developer that wants to have a subdivision road built can get it done a lot cheaper than a city can have a road or widened or something like that. So it's just, there's a lot built in that they could try and you know, great, now they've added some revenue, they ought to work on trying to keep the expense of keeping our transportation system up and running down. They could also look into maybe some of the costs that are driving up our public employee costs that actually maintain those roads, like PERS reform and a few other things. that would help out at the, for local governments in keeping the cost of maintaining a transportation system down. And you know, it's kind of like, okay, we're giving you more revenue now, state. Let's work on the cost side of the equation, which is something I think we've done really well at Lane County. Is we've worked really hard on the cost side, and we did it really well, particularly in our health insurance arena. And we did it by, you know, getting down to a couple common insurance plans for all of our employees instead of having about 20 of them for a bunch of different bargaining units. And we also did it by focusing on wellness and changing the culture of our employees to the point where we actually, for the second year in a row, have been awarded an award for being the third healthiest large employer in the state of Oregon, which sounds kind of like one of those, oh, well, you're third. We were the number one public employer, large public employer in the state of Oregon, which means we outdid, you know, Multnomah County. We outdid the city of Portland. We outdid the city of Eugene is in that same category of large public employers. We were the healthiest public employer. And that's one of the ways we've been working to control our cost here on the Bose here in Lane County. Robin, we got somebody on that wants to get on the show there.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and bring him on live. Caller, you're on the air with Jay Bozovich.
Okay, I'm ready now. This is Bob. Now that the repaving of Beltline Highway is nearing completion, what are the sheriff's office planning on, or how to, what are they planning to do to keep the speed down? Current speeds seem to be between 55 and 65, and now that the new pavement is in place, speeds are likely to increase to probably 65 to 75. That highway's unsafe now, and it certainly won't get any better with new pavement and minimal enforcement.
Yeah, and you know, Beltline's an interesting road because it actually is got three jurisdictions that can patrol it and issue tickets. In fact, I know this because my wife got a ticket from a City of Eugene police officer on Beltline when she had to speed up to try and get around somebody that was not letting her move over for her exit. One of those things, but it's a longer story. But the City of Eugene actually patrols Beltline Highway. Lane County also has jurisdiction there, although we don't do a lot of traffic enforcement because we had to make such huge cuts in our police services back in 2011 and 12 when the timber money stopped coming into Lane County. And Oregon State Police also patrols it because it is a state highway, and that is their primary mission, is to patrol state highways. But even the Oregon State Police is a half of their strength they were 30 years ago. So, you know, the two parts of that OSP and Lane County are really don't have the patrol strength we used to have. So I don't know if you'll see a lot there. I do know that we've gotten some grants recently into the sheriff's office to run a lot of overtime patrol specifically for traffic safety and looking at trouble spots based on accident data and other issues where they're doing DUII saturation patrols and speed patrols in areas that have high fatality and serious injury crashes. So, you know, Beltline shows up as one of those areas that may get some attention from the sheriff's office through those grants. But I think the City of Eugene is probably the primary traffic enforcement on Beltline Highway. Hopefully the new pavement won't see that much of a speed increase because I don't think the pavement was rough enough really to hold speeds down before. It was loud. It might have been louder in your car, but I don't think necessarily that the texture of the pavement kept people's speed down. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But I'll mention it to the sheriff and maybe talk to City of Eugene and ODOT a little bit about it and see if they're, you know, once they're done with the construction, what they're planning to do. I do know they've been doing some extra patrols at the construction zones because of some of the issues we've had this summer with accidents in construction zones and a couple workers getting injured this summer. So be interesting to see what happens when they pull the cones up. Striping's all done. So appreciate the concern.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was an interesting topic, and that wasn't one we talked about earlier, which goes to show you, if you call us, you can control the topic on the Bo's Nose Show. So we got into a little bit of Beltline Highway, which I'm sort of proud about the paving work that's getting done there, because part of that was some of the strong lobbying that Lane County and the cities and some of the entities here have done together up in the state capitol and with ODOT about focusing some money on the Beltline issues. And ultimately, we hope to get that whole Willamette River Bridge and some of the interchanges a little bit safer. One of them is actually going to get a little bit of a makeover along with that repaving project this summer. The North Delta and Beltline ramps are going to get changed a little bit, and they're going to add an extra bridge over Beltline, so we don't quite see some of the merging and weaving movements that we've been seeing previously. And hopefully that will make that interchange a little bit safer, flow a little bit better. It's still not going to flow all that well because the actual issue around rush hour traffic is the actual bridge over the Willamette River, and it's not going to expand that. That project to expand that bridge and ultimately fix Beltline is actually in the environmental assessment phases of work. And that's actually something we did get funding for from the legislature. And after those environmental assessments are all done, then we'll be looking for construction funding ultimately in the long run. Hopefully one of these days I'll be able to look back and say, I helped push for that project that fixed Beltline. But not going to be tomorrow, that's for sure, because we're still, you know, nowadays we have to go through this NEPA, National Environmental Protection Act process, doing all these environmental studies and economic studies and social impact studies of, you know, what that various improvements. We had to take, you know, three preferred alternatives into that process. This NEPA process will determine the final, you know, preferred alternative. And that's what we'll be trying to get construction money for. And it looks like it's going to be a pretty massive project of around $250 to $280 million in the long run. So it's going to be a big project to try and solve that problem on Beltline and the Willamette River from Delta Highway over to River Road. Because frankly, what got built way back in the early 60s was a mishmash of on and off ramps and spaghetti that wouldn't meet today's standards. Some of it was done to save money, and some of it was done to not raise political problems of not having a ramp on certain roads. And it's a mess. It's going to take a while to clean it up. But it is something we've been working on consistently, and the Lane County folks, the Board of Commissioners, and working in conjunction with the City of Eugene and other partners have been pushing really hard to get that kept as a priority of the state through the Lane Area Commission on Transportation and the Oregon Commission of Commission on Transportation, and really trying to keep Beltline a high profile, along with the work I've done to try and get 126 from Eugene out to Florence improved. And we've actually seen that paving work happening this summer too. I actually have more concerns about the speed of traffic on that road post paving than I do on Beltline, because that road actually had a lot of potholes in it that truly did slow traffic down to some extent. And it's going to be nice, smooth pavement. One of the things I think they're doing with that project is they're adding some rumble strips to the center line and shoulders that will hopefully keep things a little bit safer, because it'll give people warning when they're crossing those those edges and safety zones and maybe wake them up and have them pull over back into their lanes. So we'll see what happens with that project. And ultimately, there's a long-term project there to actually widen the road between Eugene and Bonita out to four lanes, which will really help out because at that point, they'll be able to put in a centerline barrier, wall like there is on Beltline. Can't do it on a two-lane roadway because if you do that, you can't get emergency vehicles around an accident and respond to accidents if you do that on a two-lane road, put a center line divider in it. So it has to be at least four lanes wide or two lanes with a shoulder that can be an alternative traffic lane. And none of those are present right now, 126 between Eugene and Bonita. So just a couple minutes left on the Bo's Nose Show here. Can still take a call at 646-721-9887 because one of the wonders of internet radio is I can go beyond my hour if I've got a caller on and we haven't finished our conversation. And it's a great thing about internet radio. You can also listen to this show archived on the internet and get to it through the KRBN Internet News Talk Radio Facebook page, or if you just Google KRBN Internet Radio, you'll get to the actual blog talk radio page for the show, and you can listen to past episodes there of the Bo's Nose Show. And you can listen, if you didn't quite catch the show live, you can listen to the show tomorrow again. So wonders of internet radio lives on forever and also is able to don't have to actually catch the live show to catch the show. And we don't have to stick to an hour either.
And we're broadcasting worldwide and Bob proved once again that you don't have to be afraid to ask Jay a question.
Yep. And I may not always have the answer and I may not have the answer you want because definitely, I don't think there's one of my real concerns has been our patrol strength of both the Oregon State Patrol and the Sheriff's Patrol and its impact on traffic safety. 10 years ago, before we lost the timber funding and we had a traffic team in Lane County, we wrote approximately 25,000 tickets a year. Now we write about 3,000. And most of those tickets are written after somebody's had a wreck or some other incident, and it's a after the fact ticket, like somebody gets busted for a Dewey after they've wrecked their car. Those are the kind of tickets that get written now for the most part. There's not a lot of, enforcement for safety purposes that goes on. It's usually, a ticket that's written, as part of some other stop possibly. So just not the enforcement we should have that really helps in safety. And we had a report last week from our traffic fatality investigation team at Lane County. We're actually doing a little bit better with some of the focus we're having, some of the changes we're making in our roadways, adding the rumble strips. Adding better signage, getting the word out there. But there are three E's to traffic safety. Engineering is just one of them. Education is another piece, what we can do in some of our, getting the word out about driving slower, not driving distracted, et cetera. But enforcement is a big part of that and probably one of the most impactful ways to quickly change driver behaviors. And unfortunately, that's the one place we have not been able to change here in Lane County. So we're still trying to work on how we can beef up our enforcement and how we can work with the legislature to get our partners at OSP beefed up. Well, we're running out of time on the Bo's Nose Show one more time. I appreciate those folks that tuned in and listened. We'll be back here next week live from beautiful downtown Elmira. Hope you have a great week. We'll talk to you then.